KMUW's podcast platform is made possible by High Touch Technologies, a software, technology, and business communications company that provides products, services, and support to all industries. High Touch brings the human touch to technology with a world-class team of industry experts. Learn more at hightouchtechnologies.com.
This is Marginalia, a production of KMUW Wichita.
Marginalia. Notes in the margin of a book.
Notes, commentary, and similar material written in the margin of a book.
Comments and notes
which are incidental or additional to the main topic
in the margin of a book.
Born in Texas and raised in Chad, Aaron Brown now lives in Kansas, where he is an assistant professor of writing and editing at Sterling College. With National Poetry Month just around the corner, he stopped by the KMUW studios to visit with me about his new poetry collection, Acacia Road, as well as pass on a few tips for people like me who are intimidated by the genre. I'm Beth Golay, this is Marginalia, and here's our conversation. Your book of poems, it's divided into three sections. Can you talk to me a little bit about the makeup of, you know, how the poems came together and what those three sections are about?
Yeah, absolutely. So I'm kind of a poet who loves structure, and I love to write towards kind of an idea of a book. And so when I was starting out on this, I realized that it needed three parts. The first part is kind of more childhood-based poems, poems of kind of like reclamation, reclaiming memories of childhood and all the wonderful, amazing things that I had there with my friends in Chad. And then it kind of ends with this destabilizing moment of trauma where we were staying at the time in the capital city of Chad, and a massive coup d'etat attempt happened, fighting on the streets. We didn't know what would happen next. And sure enough, some looters came into our house and crazy stuff happened, and that was kind of a moment of violence that caused us to leave ultimately. That's what leads into the second part, where I'm kind of traveling. You see a lot more poems based in places like Istanbul and France, and places where we kind of had to live for a few months before we were allowed back in to Chad for my senior year. And so that second part is just kind of like wrestling with almost like a sense of exile from your home, from childhood. You know, I was 17, dealing with all these things, like missing my friends, worrying for them and all that. And then that third part then is a lot of memories and poems that came much later when, as an adult, I'm trying to kind of pull everything back together again. You know, I've got first part of childhood, second part of exile, and the third part of just kind of like seeking restoration, trying to connect all the dots, feeling dislocated physically, but searching nevertheless just for like a sense of belonging and all that. So trying to pull all those loose ends together in that third part.
So talk to us a little bit about what took you to Chad. Why did you spend time there, and how long were you there?
Absolutely, yes. My parents were missionaries. My dad is a doctor. My mom, an engineer, a math teacher, also taught English. And we were there for 10 years from when I was 8 to 18. So big formative years, teenage years. People always ask me, you know, what was it like? And it's something I certainly wouldn't trade for anything, despite some of those more traumatic moments. Living in Chad was such a gift to me, experiencing hospitality. You know, so many of these poems are just about hanging out with my friends, you know, going out to the riverside and skipping stones and drinking tea, endless cups of tea throughout the whole book. A super important time for me. Grew up speaking Arabic, you know, for me and my brother. If we wanted friends, we had to get out there in the community and speak Arabic, and that's what we did.
Maybe I should have you read something from that first section.
Yeah. So I'm going to start with a poem. It's kind of my go-to poem. It's called Batha River, and it's about this river that ran around our town. It was kind of the gathering place. For most of the year, it would be empty. Even though it was a river, it's called an ephemeral river. And it only fills up for 2 or 3 months out of the year during rainy season, when the lake to the south overflows and water finally comes rushing in. But the day that that river fills up is this like really joyful day, right? That's like when you get your fishing line, you get your friends, you get your buddies, and you head out to the river. This is what this poem is about, that day that the waters come in, and what an amazing moment it is. Batha River. They say this land was once an ocean, but I have not found the shells to prove it. The dry riverbed slithers like the trail of a prehistoric snake, its scales leaving the ruts and cracks along the bank, dried and caked, sandstone by sun and drought. As a child, I came to it, the Batha. I saw a sea of dunes dimpling the surface, saw a train of pack animals exposed under the hot season sun, hooves treading grains like water, fording the absent river at a snoring pace. The scratch and rasp of foliated bone on sand, groan of wood bundles tied against their blistered backs. Their journey was endless, as a boy's eyes would make it seem, seeing their trajectory up a hill and through twisted thorn trees to villages I would never go. But I would return some years later, a few years older, when the clouds emptied like a jug, drops birthed by harmattan wind, my friends and I traversing bog and bird trees, standing under the mighty haraza, a tree so tall the clouds settled in its leaves, the branches marked the four winds. In its roots, we found stones brought from the depths of earth, shaped by a thousand years of ocean, warmed by desert sun in our eager hands. We had waited 3 months to hear the news, to hear of it coming from the southern lake swelled by rain, turning and overturning the dunes and rocks and roots, sand turned to mud, turned to liquid, risen 3 feet, then 10, the villagers waiting with fish lines, rushing the word faster downstream than the water rose. My friends heard the news on market day, brought it through my door, and so we came, stones in hand, coiling out our wrists in unison. We threw them, a skip, a second, a third, submerged.
You know, when I first read that, you could have been talking about Kansas in the first part.
It's funny, when I moved to Kansas, you know, for my job at Sterling College, I was so surprised at the similarities with Chad. It was eerily similar. I mean, it started with when I was driving in for my interview, and I drove by this exotic animal farm north of Hutchinson, and there were a bunch of camels out there. And I saw them and I blinked and I was like, I could be like where I grew up, you know, I could be in Chad right now. I think especially now in springtime, before the rains start happening here in Kansas, the wind picks up and all the dust that comes up, you know, sometimes you can see some, you know, dust devils, again, exactly like Chad. When we live in a tiny town too in central Kansas, small town culture, I think, is universal, you know, everyone knows everything about everyone, whether you're in south of the Sahara or you're in the Midwest. And so, yeah, the similarities are definitely eerily similar. At the same time, it's hard. You know, it's certainly the culture is different and the language is different. But like I said, you know, small town culture is universal and friendships are universal. And, you know, I think, you know, maybe American culture, we're busier. And I think in Chad, one thing I miss about Chad, you know, you see it in a lot of these poems, but just taking time. In Chadian Arabic, there's no word for boredom. And so, you know, you spend your afternoons drinking tea, and that is what you're supposed to do with your friends. You're supposed to sit on a mat in some shade and talk about life. And I think in America, even in the Midwest, even when, you know, life is slower here, but in America, we really struggle with slowing down, I think.
You mentioned there was a moment or an event that caused your family's exile before you were allowed back. And I think I recall that.
Yeah. And Jemina, meaning We Will Rest, is one of the poems that kind of talks about it specifically in 26.
Would you mind reading that one?
Sure, absolutely. So I'll just say quickly, N'Djamena is the name of the capital city of Chad, and that's where we were when that kind of moment of violence happened. And its original name during colonial times under the French was Fort Lamy, so Fort Lamy, because it was a base for the French army. But once they were able to kick out the French colonialists, they renamed the city to N'Djamena, meaning like we will rest from the French. We will have rest finally. But the sad thing is that since independence, you know, Chad has never had a peaceful transition of power between presidents. It had about a 10-year civil war, and then ever since then, constant rebellion and destabilization. So this is a poem, you know, that I think not only speaks to my personal experience, but also I think speaks to what's going on in the nation, what has gone on in the nation for years. So N'Djamena, meaning we will rest. The day the looters broke into our house was the shot fired as my father yelled, and the fear that came with the window darkened but the men looking in, and the scuffing of sandals on a packed dirt yard, the grind of metal loosened, the voices between walls, and the bullet that never came, and the hack job that never was, by a drunken soldier wielding a machete, under-oiled and overused, on thickets by roads and rows of bodies. I waited for an execution, like at my friend's house 2 years before, when a rebel was found hiding and forced to kneel, a bullet to his brain. I waited against the wall seeking flatness, transparency, hoping the shadows never recede. This was the end of going to bed with no thought of fear, the beginning of chilled sweats, the beginning of sounds signaling the departure of a place once known. The sound of curtains riding wind, ceiling fans beating air, the sound of opened bags and belongings strewn across the floor, of receding taillights in a street littered with empty shells.
I wanted to talk to you, I wanted to ask a little bit about the life of a poem from origin to completion. Mm. I mean, what, you know, there are so many poems throughout. We talked about the different times of your life, what they represent. But, I mean, did you wait years to explore them through poetry? I mean, did you have to pull them from the recesses of your mind? Mm. Or were you able to write in the moment?
Yeah, absolutely. When we moved to Chad, my grandmother always told me and my brother, you know, keep a journal, you know, be writing what you're seeing. And both me and my brother are like, ah, grandma, you know, we don't need to keep a journal. We'll remember all this. So I didn't really keep a journal. But what I found was eventually in high school that poetry was a way of recording what I was seeing. Granted, all those high school poems, of course, are mushy, emotional, whatever. And they were mainly just the direct experience, like what I was seeing, put it down on paper. But I had to go through a transition. It started in college, and then it really took off in my graduate program, where, you know, that physical distance of time, you know, it took about 5-6 years before I was able to really deal with those memories and process them and not just record them, but try to do something with the memories. And even also to wrestle with the fact that memories change, and to interrogate memories a little bit, and to realize that, you know, I'm kind of grasping at something that's quickly evaporating, almost like, you know, kind of quicksand or something like that, like an hourglass, you know, like memories are kind of like that. So the distance definitely helped. And I think as I matured and continue to grow as a poet, you know, I had to add some extra layers to wrestling with memory and exploring that in poetry. You talk about process. You asked about process. A lot of these poems began with maybe a line in my head or a glimpse of that memory, you know, and I just would suddenly, maybe I'd wake up or I'd be walking around and I'd be like, oh my goodness, I haven't written about that yet. Something maybe would trigger it, you know. I would be in Chicago and I would smell car exhaust, and suddenly I felt like I was on the streets of N'Djamena and, you know, surrounded by taxis and the market smell and all sorts of stuff. And that's what suddenly would evoke all these memories. So it's just odd, you know, I can't quite explain exactly how a poem starts. I think each poem started differently. But, you know, as soon as I got to a chance to sit down at the page, I'd start writing and I'd get it down. And then, of course, I'd have to think about it. Once it was down, I'd have to revise. I'd have to spend a lot of time with it and keep kind of sculpting at it until it finally took shape.
Well, it's funny talking about sculpting and talking about shape, because as I read your collection, you know, these poems all, they have a different look to them. They have a different, you know, we've talked, I don't know enough about poetry to understand what I'm even seeing, because I think one was elegy, a communion versus elegy. So pages 61 versus 62. I mean, these two have a completely different look to them, and I'm assuming a different rhythm. And so maybe you could read both of those and we can, you know, you can explain to me what it is I'm
absolutely
seeing.
So first one, communion, I'll start that, and then I'll finish it and I'll go straight into elegy, because I think I usually actually read them together. Communion. When you promised you would return but didn't. When you unlatched the blue door and looked my way one last time and said you'd be back. when the others placed a hand on my shoulder and said, "He's lying. He has no intention of coming again." When I shook my head and replied, "But he just told me." When I saw you, years later, both of us grown men, and you with a new wife and child, when you came and took a seat by the gum tree and poured a glass, when the vapor rose from the surface and I could smell the leaf and mint, when we took slow sips, when the swallows broke from the neighbor's thatch roof and were consumed in the twilight haze, then, and only then, could we share a kind of silence, the pause between one cup of tea and the next. Elegy. We were supposed to become old men, our wives mingling as friends, grinding millet to powder over the conversation of stifling afternoons, and our children giggling meanwhile, shooting marbles and flipping cards, the games we used to play not too long ago. We were supposed to be two old men sharing in the silence of empty tea glasses, laughing at God's humor instead of just me wondering why he'd want you when I still do. Yeah, in terms of the shape of these poems, I mean, they're both about different friends. The first one is in a kind of a column where it's justified both on the left and the right. And so it looks, we could talk about sculpting, and it certainly looks like a pillar.
Mm-hmm.
And rhythmically, you know, it has that kind of refrain, that anaphora of just using win, win, win. And it kind of builds that way. And I think I wanted to just kind of physically embody what was happening with this friendship that, you know, it's one of those silly teenage stories where you have a falling out with a friend over something stupid. And then, you know, you grow up a little bit and you come together again and you just kind of laugh at it and you share a cup of tea and you realize that your friendship is still something solid, is something pillar-like. And so formally I was trying to do that, you know, with what you actually visually see on the page. And then elegy, I write a lot in couplets and two-line stanzas. And I think, you know, I just wanted, a lot of it's very minimal, very short lines in this poem. It's a very short poem. And I just wanted to kind of use some of that white space of the page just to kind of piece out exactly what it's like to have this friendship and then lose it to death. And so, yeah, I think these are, you know, two examples, short poems, short flashes of memory, but kind of doing slightly different things.
I recall one poem in here. Now I have to find it. See, my problem is I marked everything. Do you see that?
Yeah.
I think it took place in Paris.
Yeah.
But was there a demonstration going on?
Yes. Okay, that's coming of age. Yeah, so this was during that kind of period of exile I talked about, which wasn't really exile, but it was just us kind of living in Paris at the time and just kind of waiting to be approved to go back for the country to open up again. I was a junior in high school trying to catch up on the schoolwork and just kind of wander around, you know. So like when I wasn't busy with reading and all my assignments, I would just walk out and walk around Paris. And it always cracked me up that every Thursday, especially in the Montparnasse district that we were living in, students would just protest. I was never sure exactly what they were protesting against, but it was such a part of the culture. So this is a poem where I just see it, I experience it, and try to make sense of it at the same time. Coming of age. Along Boulevard de Montparnasse on a Thursday, a protest day, I walked not knowing my mistake until it was too late, when swarms of university students, a year or so older than me, swept the street. Sirens blared, police took up positions, and down one alley and then another I came to them, not knowing what they protested against, only that they stood in my way from an afternoon walk when I wanted to see something more than marching feet, upended trash cans. I tried to cross the swelling boulevard, got caught in the sweep, an undertow that pulled me side to side and always down towards the Eiffel Tower, looming distant. And looking out across the raised fists and linked arms, I saw an entrance to the metro on my left side of the road. Dropped down the stairs and found the crowd there too, drumming on metal bars and scaling turnstiles, pushing me up to the surface. I fled back to my quiet street, the street named after some mountain, the street where a bakery stood at its end to hold the masses from my chip-painted door, which drew apart with a tug of my hand and clicked together again, myself inside, down in the basement where the beams held the centuries-old building together with a groan. I tried to forget the chants, the fists, the linked arms blocking my way. That was 5 years ago. But what about 13, when I stood as a boy in Florence and watched a train of Hare Krishnas come through, an undulating wave of shaved heads and faces glossed serene, men and women beating the drum, men and women dancing and joining their voices in a deep-hearted song. And I could only watch and ask, who are they, as their music flooded the street and took minutes more to fade as they passed down. I felt the tug to join them, to dance with abandon as the crowd looked on, but I didn't. For days, whether in a museum or a bookstore, scanning the shelves, cup of hot chocolate in hand, I couldn't think of anything but shaved heads and saffron sweeping robes.
Now, I noticed in the acknowledgments, quite a few of these poems have been published in literary journals or, you know, maybe in anthologies. And I was wondering, are they like short stories where they evolve and they change with each publication? Or once your poem is done, is it just done?
Oh, yeah. I mean, for me, a poem is never finished. I mean, even some of these poems that appeared previously in magazines are in different shapes. Sometimes I change words. I'm always tweaking, always adjusting, always trying to strengthen. You know, and of course, like the publishing industry can move so slowly. You know, a poem can get accepted. You know, of course, you submit it and then you wait, you know, several months. And then if it gets accepted, then you have to wait, you know, 6 or 9 months more for the issue to come out. And then suddenly it's, you know, it's 2 years later, or a year and a half later, and you look at it and you're like, I wrote that. Huh. I see some flaws, you know, and then you have to, and then that's when you go and revise and strengthen it and all that, you know, some distance helps there. But yeah, you're right. And, you know, it's also like a short story collection where, you know, you have to kind of send out your poems first and get them published in magazines and kind of gain some interest, kind of, you know, get people to sample your work. And then as you're doing that, you're also trying to pull the whole collection together as a book. And kind of, you know, eventually when you start to send it out to publishers, you know, it kind of acts as a bit of a stamp of approval, you know, when you're like, you know, I've had poems and journals, you know, here it is. It's almost like I like to use the metaphor for like music albums, you know, it's like first you have your samples or your demos, you know, that go on the radio and you get people interested. And then finally you get the mixtape or the EP or the full length from that. So that's a metaphor my students seem to get when they're talking about poetry.
We are approaching April, which is National Poetry Month, and a lot of people like me are intimidated by poetry. Do you have any advice?
Yeah, certainly I have a lot of recommendations. I think about this all the time. Number one, I think it's good for readers of poetry to realize that poets themselves walk around with a bit of not a chip on their shoulder, but a kind of a sense of doubt. I'm certainly aware as a poet that poetry has its limits. As beautiful a thing as poetry is, I recognize that poetry can't say everything. It's so microscopic. It's so, you know, it's about freezing the moment and pointing us to beauty and truth. In some ways, I think our school system, both, you know, public schools, but also colleges, we're all guilty of it. All teachers are guilty of it. I think we try to teach students that poems are something to be solved. You know, you like, here's the formula, solve for X. And that's not what a poem is. Rather, I think poems are something to be experienced, not something to be solved per se. So you step into a poem, you know, you feel it out. As Billy Collins says, you don't try to torture a confession out of it. Poetry isn't necessarily going to radically transform you. You know, poetry is vast and very different. I think starting out with narrative poetry, which is like a lot of the kinds of poetry I write, you know, story-based poetry is really good for readers that are, you know, a little anxious. Not all poems are abstract and difficult, even though T.S. Eliot says we should write poems like that. I disagree. So yeah, I mean, I think we just need to lower the stakes a little bit and be comfortable with the sense of unknowing and just enjoy the language sometimes too.
That was Erin Brown, author of the poetry collection Acacia Road, which was published by Silverfish Review Press. Thanks for joining us for Marginalia. Discover more episodes at kmuw.org or wherever you get your podcasts. Marginalia is produced at KMUW Wichita. Our engineers are Mark Statzer and Torin Anderson. Our editors are Luann Stevens and Haley Krausen, and I am the producer. This is Marginalia, and for KMUW, I'm Beth Golay.